Swim for it! And Luis and Amara hopped over the side, half swimming, half tumbling toward shore.
No, wait!
Isabel cried. Her mother couldn't swim for the beach. Not like this. They had to paddle in or her mother would never make it to the U.S. Isabel and Papi and Señor Castillo rowed as hard as they could. But the Coast Guard ship was faster. It was going to catch them.
Go!
Isabel's mother told her husband between pants.
If you're caught, they'll send you back.
No,
Papi said.
Go!
Mommy said again.
If I'm caught, they'll just send me back to Cuba. Go and take Isabel. You can send money like you always planned. No!
Isabel cried, and amazingly, her father agreed.
Never, he insisted. I need you, Teresa. You and Isabel and little Mariano.
Isabel's mother sobbed at the name, and tears sprang to Isabel's eyes, too. Like the boat, they had never settled on a name for the baby. Not until now. Naming the baby after Lito was the perfect way to remember him, no matter where they were.
But they'll send us back,
Mommy sobbed.
Then we'll go back, Papi said. Together.
He put his forehead to his wife's temple and held her hand, taking Señora Castillo's place as Mommy made her last push. The Coast Guard ship bounced in the waves. It was almost on top of them.
It's time, Señor Castillo said. We have to swim for it. Now!
No, please,
Isabel begged, paddling helplessly against the tide, tears running down her face. They were so close. But Señor Castillo was already helping his wife over the side into the water. They were abandoning ship. Isabel's mother cried out louder than before, but Papi was with her. He would take care of her. All that mattered now was rowing, rowing as hard as Isabel could. She was her mother's last hope.
Take Isabel with you,
she heard her mother say between pushes. But Isabel wasn't worried. She knew her father wouldn't listen, that he would never leave. Neither of them would. They were a family. They would be together. Forever. But then suddenly arms were picking her up, lifting her over the side.
Say goodbye to Fidel,
Señor Castillo said. He was the one Mommy had been talking to. He had come back, and he was the one lifting Isabel out of the boat and into the water.
No! No!
Isabel cried.
You saved my life once. Now let me save yours,
Señor Castillo told her. Isabel didn't listen. She kicked and screamed, trying to get free. She didn't want to go to the States if it meant leaving her parents, her family, behind. But Señor Castillo was too strong. He tossed her in the water, and she sank under the waves in a tangle of arms and legs and bubbles before quickly hitting bottom. Isabel found her footing and pushed herself back up out of the water. It was chest deep, and the waves that slid by her toward shore lifted her up and set her down again on the sand. Iván's cap had come off her head in her splashdown, and she snatched it up before it disappeared in the surf. Then she grabbed the side of the boat to climb back in. Señor Castillo's arm went around her waist and pulled her away.
No!
Isabel cried.
I won't leave them!
Hush! We're not going anywhere, Señor Castillo said. Help us pull the boat to shore!
Isabel looked around, and for the first time she saw that Señora Castillo was still there, and Luis and Amara were there too. They all stood waist-deep in the water around the boat. They had come back. They all found somewhere to grab onto the boat and pull, churning up the sand at their feet. Isabel sobbed with relief and grabbed hold. It was harder for her to pull when the waves kept lifting her, but the sight of the Coast Guard boat bearing down on them helped motivate her. So did the cheering. The other refugees on the Coast Guard ship were hopping up and down and clapping and yelling encouragement, just like the crowd on the beach had when they'd left Havana. Isabel saw her grandfather running up and down the ship, waving them toward shore like a baseball player urging a home run ball around the foul pole. She laughed in spite of herself. The water was just below Isabel's waist. They were almost there. The Coast Guard ship cut its engines to run up to them, and that's when Isabel heard her baby brother cry out for the first time. The sound stunned Isabel and the others into stillness. It took her father a moment to cut the umbilical cord with his pocket knife. Then he stood up in the boat with something tiny and brown, staring down at it like he held the world's most incredible treasure in his arms. Isabel gaped. All this time she had known her mother was having a baby. Isabel had seen plenty of babies before. They were cute, but nothing special. But this wasn't just a baby. This was her brother. She had never met him before this moment, but she loved him now with a deepness she had never felt before, not even toward Iván. This was Mariano, her little brother, and she suddenly wanted to do anything and everything she could to protect him. Papi finally looked up from his newborn son.
"Help me get Teresa out of the boat," he told the others.
The Coast Guard ship was almost alongside the boat, and the adults scrambled for the other side. Papi bent down over the bow and held out her crying baby brother to Isabel. As if in a dream, Isabel's arms reached up and took him. He was covered with something slimy and gross, and was screaming like somebody had slapped him. But he was the most amazing thing Isabel had ever seen. Little Mariano. Isabel hugged him protectively against the push and pull of the waves. He was so tiny, so light. What if she stumbled? What if she dropped him? How could her father put something so new, so precious, in her arms? But then she understood. Isabel had to carry little Mariano to shore, so her father and the others could carry Mommy behind them.
"Go, Isabel," her father told her.
And she went. Isabel held the baby up high to keep him out of the waves that pushed them both to shore, stumbling as the water crashed against the back of her legs, but step by step, she staggered up onto the beach. Onto United States soil. Isabel turned in the sand, soaking wet and exhausted, to look behind her. Papi and Amara and the Castillos were on their feet, carrying Isabel's mother through the shallow water, where the Coast Guard boat couldn't go. The ship had cut its lights and was backing out to sea. On the rear of the boat, among the waving, cheering refugees, was Isabel's grandfather. Isabel held the screaming baby up high for him to see, and Lito fell to his knees, hands clasped to his chest. Then the engines roared, the sea churned, and the Coast Guard ship disappeared out to sea. The Castillo and Fernandez families helped each other up onto the sandy beach, and their wet feet became dry feet. Señor Castillo fell to his knees and kissed the ground. They had made it to the States, to freedom. Still in a dream, Isabel wobbled up the sand toward the flashing lights and thumping music and dancing people. She stepped into the light, and the music stopped, and everyone turned to stare. Then suddenly people were running to help her and her family. A tan young woman in a bikini dropped into the sand beside Isabel.
"Oh my God, chiquita," she said in Spanish. "Did you just come off a boat? Are you Cuban?"
"Yes," Isabel said. She was trembling, but she clung to Mariano like she would never let him go.
"I'm from Cuba,"
Isabel said.
But my little brother was born here. He's an American, and soon I will be too.
Mahmoud, Hungary to Germany, 2015. 17 days from home. Hungarian people on both sides of the road stopped and stared as Mahmoud and the rest of the refugees marched down the middle of the highway. Men, women, children, they had all come pouring out of the detention center after Mahmoud, joined by the UN observers, and the police had done nothing to stop them. The refugees stretched from one side of the northbound lane to the other, blocking cars from passing them. Packs of young Syrian men walked and laughed together. A Palestinian woman pushed a stroller with a sleeping girl in it. An Afghan family sang a song. The refugees wore jeans and sneakers and hoodies tied around their waists and carried what little they still owned in backpacks and trash bags. Mahmoud's father and mother found him and Walid in the crowd.
"Mahmoud, what are you doing?" his father cried.
"We're walking to Austria," Walid said.
Dad showed them the map on his phone.
"But it's a 12-hour walk," he said.
"We can do it," Mahmoud said. "We've already come this far. We can go just a little farther."
Mahmoud's mother pulled him into a hug, and then Walid, and soon their father had joined them. Refugees streamed around them, and when Mahmoud's mother let them all go, she was smiling and crying at the same time. Cars honked behind the marchers, trying to get past. More cars stopped on the other side of the highway to honk and cheer them on or boo them. A police van pulled up on the opposite side of the road, and through a loudspeaker, a policeman told everyone in Arabic,
"Stop, or you will be arrested!"
But no one stopped, and no one was arrested. Mahmoud and his family walked with the crowd for hours, visible, exposed. It was scary, but energizing too. They marched quietly, calmly, flashing peace signs at people who cheered them on from the sidelines. Police cars with spinning red lights paced them on the other side of the road, occasionally weep-weeping to warn some car away. News helicopters flew overhead, and a woman from the New York Times worked her way through the crowd, asking Mahmoud questions and interviewing refugees.
"See us," Mahmoud thought. "Hear us. Help us."
12 hours, it seemed like nothing when Mahmoud added up all the time they'd been walking since they'd left Aleppo. But this walk quickly seemed endless. They had no water and no food, and Mahmoud's stomach growled and his lips were dry. He felt like one of the zombies from his favorite video game. All he wanted to do was lie down and sleep. But Mahmoud knew they couldn't stop. If they stopped, the Hungarians would arrest them. They had to keep moving forward, always forward, even if it killed them. Later that night, Mahmoud and his family at last reached the border of Austria. There was no fence, no wall, no border checkpost. Just a blue traffic sign by the side of the road with the words Republik Österreich inside the EU's circle of gold stars, and above it, a sign with the red and white flag of Austria. The Hungarian police cars stopped following them as soon as they stepped across the border, and the refugees paused to hug each other and celebrate their escape. Mahmoud fell to his knees, fighting back tears of exhaustion and happiness. They had made it. It wasn't Germany, not yet, but Germany was just one country away. The refugees were still laughing and congratulating each other when the phone Mahmoud's father carried beeped an alarm. So did another phone, and another, until the whole crowd was a chorus of alarms. It was time for the Isha prayer, the last prayer of the day. Mahmoud's dad used an app called iSalam to find the exact direction they should face to pray to Mecca. Mahmoud's family found a patch of grass all to themselves, and the hundreds of other refugees did the same, and soon they were all bowing and praying together. It wasn't ideal, they were supposed to wash themselves and pray in a clean place, but it was more important to pray at the right time than in the right place. As he recited the first chapter of the Quran, Mahmud thought about the words. Thee alone we worship, and thee alone we ask for help. Show us the straight path. Their path had been anything but straight, but Allah had delivered them to this place. With His blessings, they might actually reach Germany. When Mahmud finished his prayers and opened his eyes, he saw a small group of Austrians had gathered at the edges of the praying refugees. There were police officers there too, and more cars with flashing lights. Mahmud sagged. They only see us when we do something they don't like, he thought again. The refugees had stopped to get down on their knees and pray, and these people watching them didn't do that, didn't understand. Now the refugees looked foreign again, alien, like they didn't belong. Mahmud worried what the crowd might do when the Austrians told them they didn't want them. Their march through Hungary had been peaceful until now. Would this turn into another fight that would see them gassed and handcuffed and thrown into prison again?
Welcome to Austria, one of the Austrians said, in heavily accented Arabic, and others yelled, Willkommen,
and applauded. Actually applauded them. Mahmud looked around at Walid, who was as stunned as Mahmud. Was this some mistake? Did these people think they were something other than Syrian refugees? Suddenly, they were surrounded by Austrians, men, women, and children, all smiling and trying to shake their hands and give them things. A woman gave Mahmud's mother a handful of clean clothes, and a man worried over his father's cuts and bruises. A boy about Mahmud's age, wearing a New York Yankees jersey, handed him a plastic shopping bag with bread and cheese and fruit and a bottle of water in it. Mahmud was so thankful he almost wept.
Thank you, Mahmud said in Arabic.
Bitte,
the boy said, which Mahmud guessed was German for you're welcome. The Austrians, they learned, had seen their march on the television and had come out to help them. It was like that all the way up the road to Nickelsdorf, the closest Austrian town with a train station. White, native-born Austrians and olive-skinned Arab Austrians who had recently immigrated to the country filled the overpasses, throwing bottles of water and food down to them, bread, fresh fruit, bags of chips. A man next to Mahmud caught a whole grilled chicken wrapped in aluminum foil.
We are with you! Go with God!
A woman shouted down to them in Arabic. Mahmud's heart lifted. They weren't invisible anymore, hidden away in the detention center. People were finally seeing them, and good people were helping them. At last, Mahmud and his family reached the Nickelsdorf train station, where they bought tickets to Vienna, the capital of Austria. They traveled overnight by train, and when they arrived in Vienna the next morning, they bought tickets to Munich, a large city in Germany. In Munich, the response was the same as in Austria, only bigger. There were thousands of refugees at the train station, and moving among them were hundreds of regular German people, offering bottles of water and cups of coffee and tea. One couple had brought a basket full of candy and were handing pieces out to children. Mahmud and Walid joined the happy mob of kids around them, and each got a couple of candies, which they wolfed down. A more organized effort was unloading a truck full of fresh fruit, and another group was handing out diapers to anyone with babies. Seeing the diapers reminded Mahmud of Hannah, and he looked up at his mother. He could tell she was thinking of his baby sister, too. She put a hand to her mouth, and soon she was working her way through the crowd again, asking anyone and everyone if they had seen her daughter. But no one had seen or heard of a baby plucked from the water. If the people who had rescued her made it to safety, though, they were likely somewhere here in Germany. Mahmud and his family would just have to keep looking. An official-looking German man with a name tag that said Serhat, a Turkish name, approached Mahmud's father with a clipboard in hand.
Are you and your family seeking asylum in Germany? He asked in perfect Arabic.
Mahmud held his breath. Was this it? Was the end of their long, horrible nightmare near? Could they finally stop moving, stop sleeping and praying in doorways and bus stations. In Germany, Mahmoud and his family could make new lives for themselves. Mahmoud could finally find a way to reconnect with Walid. They could find Hannah, get his dad laughing and joking again, find peace for his mom. After coming so far, after losing so much, it felt like Mahmoud and his family were almost to the promised land. All they had to do was make room in their hearts for Germany, the way it had made room for them, and accept this strange new place as their home. "Yes," Mahmoud's father said, a smile slowly growing on his face. "A thousand times yes."
Isabel, Miami, Florida, 1994. Home. This was the coda to Isabel's song. She stood with a trumpet in hand, a gift from Uncle Guillermo, Lito's brother. She wasn't on a sidewalk in Havana, but in a classroom in Miami. It was her second week of school and the first day of band class, the day they auditioned for their places in the orchestra. Isabel twiddled her fingers on the trumpet's keys. She couldn't believe she was standing here in this classroom, less than a month after stumbling onto Miami Beach with her baby brother in her arms. So much had changed so quickly. After her mother and brother had been taken to the hospital and given a clean bill of health, Lito's brother Guillermo took them in until they found a little apartment of their own. His apartment was smaller than their house in Cuba, and not near the beach, but if Isabel never saw the ocean again, that was fine by her. Little Mariano was at home, getting fat and happy along with the other babies Mommy was paid to watch at the little in-house daycare she ran. Papi had gotten a job driving a taxi and was saving up for a car of their own. Señora Castillo planned to go back to school to become an American lawyer, and Señor Castillo was already talking to someone about getting a loan to open a restaurant. Luis got work in a little bodega, and Amara in a dress shop, and once Amara became a U.S. citizen, she planned to become a Miami police officer. They were going to be married in the winter. And Isabel? She had started the sixth grade. It was hard because she didn't speak English yet, but there were other Cuban kids there, lots more Cuban kids, a few who had come to America by boat like her, but more who had been born here, Cubano-Americanos, who still spoke Spanish at home. Isabel had quickly made friends, girls and boys who were warm and welcoming, and she knew she would learn to speak English like her teachers soon enough. She was practicing by watching lots and lots of television. At least, that's what she told her parents. She would learn, and in the meantime, math and Spanish and art class all still made sense. And so did music. Señor Villanueva and the other students waited for her to play. Isabel had practiced for weeks for this moment. At first, she couldn't decide what song to play. But then, while watching a baseball game with her father, she had figured it out. Isabel adjusted Iván's Industriales baseball cap on her head, took a deep breath, and began to play the Star-Spangled Banner, the national anthem of the United States. But she didn't play it like she'd heard it at baseball games on the television. She played it like a son cubano, offbeat with a guajeo melody. Isabel played it salsa for Iván lost at sea, and for Lito back in Cuba. She played it salsa for her mother and her father, who had left their homeland, and for her little brother Mariano, who would never know the streets of Havana the way she had. And Isabel played it salsa for herself, so she would never forget where she came from, who she was. Soon, Isabel had everyone in the room clapping along to the beat with her. But as she played, she heard a different rhythm, a beat underneath the one everyone else was clapping to. Her foot tapped in time with the hidden cadence, and she realized with a thrill that she was finally hearing it. She was finally counting clave. Lito was wrong. She didn't have to be in Havana to hear it, to feel it, She had brought Kuba with her to Miami. Isabel finished with a flourish, and Señor Villanueva and the other students cheered. She thought she might cry for happiness, but she bit back her tears. She had done enough crying over Iván and Lito. The song of her leaving Cuba to find a new home was over. Today, it was time to start a new song.
Mahmoud, Berlin, Germany, 2015. Home. A German song Mahmoud had never heard before played on the radio of the van that took him and his family through the streets of Berlin. The capital of Germany was the biggest city he had ever seen, far bigger than Aleppo. It was filled with nightclubs and cafes and shops and monuments and statues and apartments and office buildings. Almost all the signs were in German, but here and there he saw a sign in Arabic advertising a clothing store or a restaurant or a market. Buildings lined the sidewalks like 10-story walls of brick and glass, and cars and bicycles and buses and trams rattled and honked and clanged by in the streets. This strange, frightening, exciting place was to be Mahmoud's new home. The German government had taken in Mahmoud and his family. For the past 4 weeks, the four of them had lived in a school in Munich that had been turned into simple but clean housing for refugees. They had stayed there, free to come and go as they pleased, until a host family agreed to let them share their home, while Mahmoud's parents got on their feet. A host family here, on this street, in the capital of the country. The van pulled up to the curb outside a little green house with white shutters and an A-frame roof. Flowers filled the window boxes like Mahmoud had seen in Austria, and two German cars were parked in the driveway. Across the street in a park, teenagers did tricks on skateboards. Mahmoud's father slid open the side door for them to climb out, and Mahmoud and his mother and brother grabbed the backpacks filled with the clothes, toiletries, and bedrolls the German relief workers had given them. The relief worker who'd driven them led Mahmoud's mother and father and brother up the steps to the front door of the little house. But Mahmoud stood for a moment on the sidewalk, looking around at the neighborhood. Mahmoud knew from his history class back in Syria that Berlin had been all but destroyed by the end of World War II, reduced to a pile of rubble like Aleppo was now. Would it take another 70 years for Syria to return from the ashes the way Germany had? Would he ever see Aleppo again? Cries of joy and welcome came from the porch, and Mahmoud followed his family up the steps. His mother was being hugged by an elderly German woman, and an elderly German man was shaking hands with his father. The German relief worker had to translate everything everyone said to each other. Mahmoud and his family didn't speak German yet, and the family apparently didn't speak any Arabic. The German family had at least managed a sign written in Arabic that said, "Welcome home," on it, even if the expression they had used was a bit formal. Mahmoud still appreciated the effort. It was better than he could do in German. The man shaking hands with his father turned to Mahmoud and Walid, and what Mahmoud saw surprised him. He was a really old man. He had wrinkly white skin and thin white hair that stuck out a bit on the sides, like he tried to comb it, but it wouldn't stay put. When the relief worker had told them they'd be staying with a German family, Mahmoud had imagined a family like his own, not like his grandparents. "His name is Saul Rosenberg," the relief worker translated, "and he says welcome to your new home." As Mahmoud shook the old man's hand, he spotted a small, thin, ornate wooden box attached to the frame just outside the front door. Mahmoud recognized the symbol on the box. It was the Star of David, the same symbol on the flag of Israel. Mahmoud tried not to show his surprise. Not only was this couple old, they were Jewish. Back in the Middle East, Mahmoud knew, Jews and Muslims had been fighting each other for decades. This was a strange new world. Herr Rosenberg's wife broke away from Mahmoud's mother and bent down to say hello. She was a wide woman, white-haired like her husband, with big round glasses and a gap-toothed friendly smile. From the pockets of her frock, she withdrew a little stuffed rabbit made of white corduroy and offered it to Walid. His eyes lit up as he took it from her.
"Frau Rosenberg made it herself. She's a toy designer," the translator explained.
The old woman said something directly to Mahmoud.
"She says she would have made one for you too," the translator said, "but she thought you might be too old for stuffed animals."
Mahmoud nodded. "She can make one for my little sister, though, when we find her," he told the relief worker. "We had to hand her off to another boat to save her when we were drowning in the Mediterranean Sea. It was my fault. I'm the one who told my mother to do it, and now I have to find her and bring her back."
Frau Rosenberg looked questioningly at the relief worker as he translated, and her bright smile faded.
Walid ran off to show his mother his new toy, and the old woman led Mahmoud into the hallway just inside the house where family pictures hung on the wall.
"I was a refugee once, just like you," the old woman said through the interpreter, "and I lost my brother."
She pointed to an old brown photograph in a picture frame of a mother and father and two children, a boy about Mahmoud's age in glasses and a little girl. The father and son wore suits and ties, and the mother wore a pretty dress with big buttons. The girl was dressed like a little sailor.
"That's Mizeo, the girl. That's my family. We left Germany on a ship in 1939, trying to get to Cuba, to escape the Nazis. I was very little then, and I'm very old now, and I don't remember too much about that time. But I do remember my father being very sick, and a cartoon about a cat, I remember that, and a very nice policeman who let me wear his hat. My father was the only one to make it to Cuba. He lived there for many years, long after the war, but I never saw him again. He died before we could find each other. The rest of us couldn't leave the ship with him, and no other country would take us. So they brought us back to Europe, just in time for the war. Just in time to go on the run again. The Nazis caught us, and they gave my mother a choice. Save me, or save my brother. Well, she couldn't choose. How could she? So my brother chose for her. His name was Joseph."
Mahmoud watched as she reached out and gently touched the boy in the photograph, leaving a smudge on the glass.
"He was about your age, I think. I don't remember much about him, but I do remember he always wanted to be a grown-up.
I don't have time for games, he would tell me. I am a man now.
And when those soldiers said one of us could go free and the other would be taken to a concentration camp, Joseph said, 'Take me.' My brother. Just a boy, becoming a man at last."
She paused a moment, then took the picture down off the wall, reverently, with both hands.
"They took my mother and my brother away from me that day, and left me alone there in the woods. I only survived because a kind old French lady took me in. She told the next Nazis who came knocking that I was family. When the war was over and I was old enough, I came back here to Germany to look for my mother and brother. I searched for them a long time, but they had died in the concentration camps. Both of them."
The woman drew a breath.
"I only have this picture of them because a cousin kept it. A cousin who was hidden away by a Christian family throughout the war. Here in Germany, I met my husband, Saul. He had also survived the Holocaust. We stayed because he had family here, and we made a family of our own," Frau Rosenberg said.
She spread her arms wide and turned in the little hallway, showing Mahmoud the dozens of pictures of her children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. She put her hand to the old yellowed picture of her family again.
They died so I could live. Do you understand? They died so all these people could live. All the grandchildren and nieces and nephews they never got to meet. But you'll get to meet them, she told Mahmoud. You're still alive, and so is your little sister, somewhere. I know it. You saved her, and together we'll find her, yes? I promise. We'll find her and bring her home.
Mahmoud started to cry, and he turned away and tried to blink back his tears. The old Jewish woman put her arms around him and pulled him into a tight hug.
Everything's going to be all right now, she whispered. We'll help you.
Ruthie, come here!
Frau Rosenberg's husband called to her. Mahmoud didn't need the translator to tell him that Herr Rosenberg wanted them to join him in the living room. Mahmoud dragged a sleeve across his wet eyes, and Frau Rosenberg tried to hang the picture back on the wall. Her old hands were too shaky, though, and Mahmoud took it from her and hung it back on its nail for her. His gaze lingered on the picture. He was filled with sadness for the boy his age, the boy who had died so Ruthie could live. But Mahmoud was also filled with gratitude. Joseph had died so Ruthie could live, and one day welcome Mahmoud and his family into her house. The old woman gave Mahmoud's arm a squeeze, and she led him into the living room. Mom and Dad were there, and Walid, and Herr Rosenberg, and the space was bright and alive and filled with books and pictures of family and the smell of good food. It felt like a home.
This is Kyla Garcia. We hope that you have enjoyed this production of Refugee by Alan Gratz. Joseph's story was read by Michael Goldstrom. Isabel's story was read by Kyla Garcia. And Mahmoud's story was read by Asaf Cohen. This program was produced at Dion Audio and directed by Kyle Verville. Executive producer Paul R. Gagné. Original music by Scotty Huff. Editing and mastering by Alex Martinez. Print edition published by Scholastic Press, an imprint of Scholastic Inc. Text copyright 2017 by Alan Gratz. Production copyright 2017 by Scholastic Inc. All rights reserved.
Author's note. Joseph, Isabel, and Mahmoud are all fictional characters, but their tales are based on true stories. Joseph. The MS St. Louis was a real ship that set sail from Nazi Germany in 1939 with 937 passengers on board, almost all of them Jewish refugees trying to escape the Nazis. The Jews expected to be admitted to Cuba, some of them to live there permanently, some to stay only temporarily until they were admitted to the United States or to Canada. But when they arrived, the Jews were told they would not be allowed to land. The reason was political. The Cuban official who had issued the refugees' entrance visas had fallen out of favor with Cuba's president at the time, Federico Bru. To embarrass the official, Bru retroactively canceled the Jews' visas. Nazi agents in Havana helped keep the Jews out, too, by spreading propaganda that turned the Cuban people against the refugees. The Germans didn't want the Jews in their country, but they also loved seeing the refugees turned away by other countries. To the Nazis, it was proof that everybody else in the world secretly agreed with the way the Germans were treating the Jews. Captain Gustav Schroeder was real, and he is remembered today for his kindness toward his Jewish passengers and his efforts to find refuge for them. Otto Schindick was real too, and was not only the Nazi Party representative on the ship, but also something of a spy, carrying secret messages back and forth between Germany and the Nazi agents working in Havana. Evelyn and Renata were the real names of two sisters whose mother chose to remain in Nazi Germany. Their father, Dr. Max Auber, was able to get them off the St. Louis in Havana because he had gone ahead of his family to Cuba and had strong connections with the local authorities. None of the other passengers were so lucky. Joseph's father, Aaron Landau, was inspired by two different men who really sailed on the MS St. Louis, Aaron Posner and Max Lowe. Aaron Posner, a Hebrew teacher, had been taken from his home in Germany during Kristallnacht, the night of broken glass, and sent to Dachau, where he was beaten and humiliated, and where he witnessed incredible atrocities. It was Aaron Posner who was released from Dachau after 6 months and told to leave the country within 14 days. And it was Posner who was the victim of Otto Schindick and his firemen while on board. Posner was also one of the mutineers who tried to take control of the ship when the St. Louis was turned away from the United States and Canada. Max Lowe was a Jewish lawyer who, like my fictional Aaron Landau, had been forbidden by the Nazis to practice law. Lowe had continued to give legal advice to sympathetic German lawyers who paid him under the table, but the Gestapo eventually caught on, and Lowe was forced into hiding. He joined his wife and two children, a boy and a girl, just in time for them to all board the MS St. Louis and make their escape. But like Aaron Landau, Max Lowe was a broken man when he rejoined his family. It was Lowe who tried to commit suicide by jumping off the St. Louis while it lay at anchor outside Havana Harbor. The English ship Ordunia and the French ship Flander, both carrying Jewish refugees bound for Cuba, were initially kept out of Havana Harbor, just like the St. Louis. But both ships, to the frustration of the passengers on the St. Louis, were eventually allowed to dock and disembark their own refugees. But what the passengers on the St. Louis didn't know was that the only people allowed off the Ordunia and the Flander were passengers with Cuban passports. The rest, mostly Jews with now invalid entry visas like the Jewish passengers on the St. Louis, had been turned away to find another country that would take them. The Jewish refugees from the St. Louis who were allowed to enter the United Kingdom were the lucky ones. They escaped the Holocaust. Of the 620 Jewish refugees who returned to continental Europe, the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum estimates that 254 of them were among the 6 million European Jews who died in the Holocaust. Most of these people were murdered in the killing centers of Auschwitz and Sobibor, says the museum. The rest died in internment camps, in hiding, or attempting to evade the Nazis. Ruthie, who survived, would be among the approximately 100,000 Jews who live in Germany today, down from around 500,000 Jewish German citizens before World War II. Many more Jews who survived the Holocaust chose not to return to their European home countries, settling instead in the United States and the newly formed country of Israel. The tragedy of the MS St. Louis is now famous and has been the subject of many books, plays, films, and even an opera. Isabel. In 1994, thanks in large part to the recent collapse of the Soviet Union and the ongoing U.S. embargo against trade with Cuba, hungry citizens of Havana rioted up and down the Malecón. In response, Cuban President Fidel Castro announced that anyone who wanted to leave Cuba could do so without being thrown in jail, which was the usual punishment for trying to escape. It was a strategy Castro had employed before. When protests threatened to overwhelm his security forces and overthrow his government, Castro would allow people to leave any way they could, usually on homemade boats and rafts. When all the people angry enough to fight him had fled to America, the protests would stop and things would settle back down again. In the 5 weeks in 1994 when Castro allowed unhappy citizens to leave Cuba, an estimated 35,000 people fled the island for the United States, almost 10 times the number of people who had tried to escape to America in all of 1993. Many Americans objected to the sudden influx of Cuban refugees, particularly because, at the time, Cubans enjoyed a unique path to becoming American citizens that immigrants from other countries did not. Others recognized Castro's ploy for what it was and argued that the protesters should remain in Cuba in the hope that their riots would finally overthrow the Cuban government. U.S. President Bill Clinton had a big decision to make: let the Cuban refugees in or send American warships out to turn them away. While he tried to figure out what to do, Clinton ordered any Cuban refugees caught at sea to be sent to a refugee camp at the U.S. military base at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. From there, Cuban refugees could choose to return to Cuba or wait and see if the United States or another country would take them. A few months later, in 1995, Clinton announced that the Cuban refugees at Guantanamo would be allowed entry into the United States. But from that point on, any Cuban refugees caught at sea would be sent back to Cuba, not taken the rest of the way to Florida or sent to Guantanamo. Any Cuban refugees who made it to America could stay. Isabel and her family refer to this new attitude toward Cuban refugees as wet foot, dry foot, though that name wasn't commonly used to describe the situation until the policy was officially made law in 1995. I've also used artistic license to combine the riot that prompts Isabel's family to leave with the U.S. decision to detain Cuban refugees caught at sea. Those two events actually happened a month apart, but I have brought them together here to make my story tighter and more dramatic. Despite the threat of imprisonment in Cuba and the dangers of sea swells, storms, drowning, sharks, dehydration, and starvation, increasing numbers of Cubans still try to cross the 90 miles of ocean between Havana and Florida each year. According to the Pew Research Center, 43,635 Cuban refugees entered the United States in 2015, and that number was surpassed in 2016 by October. In recent years, many Cuban refugees have skipped America's wet-foot, dry-foot policy altogether and chosen to fly or sail from Cuba to Mexico or Ecuador, and then walk north into America, an alternate route observers nicknamed Dusty Foot. But as more and more countries south of the United States close their borders, more Cubans are heading back into the Straits of Florida on homemade boats and rafts. Again, according to the Pew Research Center, 9,999 Cuban refugees entered the United States through the Miami sector in 2015. That same year, the U.S. Coast Guard apprehended 3,505 Cubans at sea. And there's no way of telling how many Cubans die in the attempt each year. In 1994, the year of Isabel's story, an estimated 3 out of every 5 Cuban refugees who attempted the journey died at sea. In 2014, President Barack Obama and Cuban President Raul Castro, Fidel's brother, announced that Cuba and the United States were reestablishing relations with each other. And in 2015, President Obama announced that formal diplomatic relations between the two countries would resume, including the reopening of their respective embassies in Havana and Washington, D.C. As a part of the normalization of relations, the U.S. government relaxed travel restrictions that had barred most Americans from visiting Cuba. And in August 2016, the first commercial flight from America to Cuba since 1962 landed in Havana. On January 12, 2017, in one of his last acts in office, President Obama announced the immediate end of the wet-foot, dry-foot policy. How these changes to U.S.-Cuban relations and the death of Fidel Castro on November 25, 2016 will affect the future of Cuba and its people remains to be seen. Mahmoud. As I record this, Syria is in its 6th year of one of the most brutal and vicious civil wars in history. The city of Aleppo, Mahmoud's hometown, lies in ruins today because it is home to a large group of rebels who oppose Bashar al-Assad's war on his own people. The city is under siege, pounded daily by Russian air attacks and Syrian army artillery. If they didn't leave by 2015 when Mahmoud and his family went on the run, the remaining citizens of Aleppo are now trapped in a war zone. According to the United Nations, more than 470,000 people have been killed since the conflict began in 2011. That's roughly equal to the entire population of Atlanta, Georgia. And more people are dying every day. In just 1 week of fighting in September 2016, the United Nations reported the deaths of 96 children. That's like an entire grade level of children dying every week. In a major offensive in December 2016, the Syrian army conquered an estimated 95% of Aleppo's rebel-held territory, spurring a new humanitarian crisis as hundreds of thousands more civilians were caught in the crossfire. Fighting in Aleppo continues today. And those who survive often have nowhere to live. The Guardian newspaper estimates 40% of the city's infrastructure has been damaged or destroyed. Whole neighborhoods lie in ruins. Markets, restaurants, shops, apartment buildings, nothing has been spared. Almost no one goes to work anymore or to school. Every tree in the city has been cut down for firewood, and when they ran out of trees, the Syrians had to burn school desks and chairs to heat their homes. Hospitals, if they still stand, have no medicine or equipment to treat patients. It's no wonder, then, that more than 10 million Syrians have been displaced from their homes. Of those 10 million, the United Nations estimates that 4.8 million Syrians have left their country as refugees. That's more people than live in the entire state of Connecticut, or Kentucky, or Oregon. And more are fleeing every day, leaving behind everything they owned and everything they knew, just to escape the war and bloodshed, just to survive. But where do they go? The United Nations reports that Turkey is already home to more than 2.7 million registered Syrian refugees, many of them in refugee camps like the one in Kilis that Mahmoud and his family passed through. Other countries in the region, like Lebanon, Jordan, and Iraq, have all received huge numbers of Syrian refugees, but their resources are stretched to the limit, and public sentiment in many countries has turned against the influx of immigrants. Millions more refugees try to reach Europe, where countries like Germany and Sweden and Hungary have accepted hundreds of thousands of refugees. But getting there is difficult and often deadly. According to the International Organization for Migration, more than 3,770 refugees died trying to cross the Mediterranean by boat in 2015. And once they reach the European Union, refugees still face persecution and imprisonment from countries that don't want to deal with them or don't have the resources to handle the huge influx of people. Hungary was the first country to build a fence to keep out Middle Eastern refugees walking north, and more countries are building walls. Even Austria, which has been incredibly welcoming to refugees, began building a fence in 2016. According to the Migration Policy Institute, between October 1, 2011, and December 31, 2016, the United States admitted just 18,007 Syrian refugees, less than one-half of 1% of all Syrian refugees who have resettled in other countries. On January 27, 2017, President Donald Trump signed Executive Order 13769, indefinitely suspending the entry of all Syrian refugees into the United States. The executive order was titled Protecting the Nation from Foreign Terrorist Entry into the United States, despite a report by the Cato Institute that says that no person accepted into the United States as a refugee, Syrian or otherwise, has been implicated in a major fatal terrorist attack since the Refugee Act of 1980 established the current system for accepting refugees into the United States. The states of Washington and Minnesota have challenged the executive order in court, but as I record this, the outcome and the future of Syrian refugees in the United States remains unclear. The experiences of Mahmoud and his family are based on things that really happened to different Syrian refugees. In 2015, a group of about 300 refugees who had been detained at a Danish school/refugee camp finally had enough of being held for no reason. As one, they marched up the highway toward Sweden, forming a human chain that stopped traffic. And cheering bystanders really did stand on overpasses and toss down food and water. A similar protest took place in Hungary a week before, when thousands of refugees marched from Budapest to the border of Austria. I have combined the two events in this book. Mahmoud and his mother and father are composites of different refugees I read about. But Walid is specifically based on a now-famous photograph of a 5-year-old boy from Aleppo named Omran Dakhnish. In the picture, Omran sits alone in the back of an ambulance after surviving an airstrike, his feet bare, his face bloody, his body covered in dirt and gray ash. He's not crying. He's not angry. Maybe he's in shock, or maybe he's just used to this. This is the only life he knows, because his country has been at war as long as he has been alive. He is a member of what the United Nations warns will become a lost generation of Syrian children, if nothing is done to help them now. What you can do. Beverly Crawford, a professor emerita at the University of California, Berkeley, has written that refugees live three lives. The first is spent escaping the horrors of whatever has driven them from their homes, like the persecution and murder of Jews in Joseph's Nazi Germany, the starvation and civil rights abuses of Isabel's Cuba, or the devastating civil war of Mahmoud's Syria. Those who are lucky enough to escape their homes begin a second, equally dangerous life in their search for refuge, trying to survive ocean crossings and border patrols and criminals looking to profit off of them. Most migrants don't end up in refugee camps, and their days are spent seeking shelter, food, water, and warmth. But even in the camps, refugees are exposed to illness and disease and often have to exist on less than 50 cents a day. If refugees manage to escape their home and then survive the journey to freedom, they begin a third life, starting over in a new country, one where they often do not speak the language or practice the same religion as their hosts. Professional degrees granted in one country are often not honored in another. So refugees who were doctors or lawyers or teachers where they came from become store clerks and taxi drivers and janitors. Families that once had comfortable homes and cars and money set aside for college and retirement have to start all over, living with other refugees in government housing or with host families in foreign cities as they rebuild their lives. You can help refugee families by donating money to one of the many groups who help refugees through every phase of their three lives. Some nonprofit organizations have very specific missions, like rescuing people fleeing the Middle East by boat or battling disease in refugee camps. Two of my favorite organizations work specifically with refugee children around the world. The first is UNICEF, the United Nations International Children's Emergency Fund, which is working to keep Syrian children from becoming a lost generation by providing life-saving medical services, food, water, sanitation, and education, both within Syria and wherever Syrian refugees have fled. The second is Save the Children, which works with a number of corporate partners and individual donors here in the United States to offer emergency relief to children whenever and wherever it's needed around the world, including a special campaign for Syrian children. Both UNICEF and Save the Children spend 90% of every dollar they raise on services and resources that directly help children. Donations to either of these terrific organizations can be earmarked for specific regions and conflicts, or be used to help refugee children worldwide. Learn more at www.unicefusa.org and www.savethechildren.org. I will be donating a portion of my proceeds from the sale of this audiobook to UNICEF to support their relief efforts with refugee children around the world. Alan Gratz, North Carolina, USA, 2017.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.